Hello, everyone. This is Michael McCurdy from TestyMom.com, and I have the Testy Mom herself, Mrs. Karen Quinn, on the phone as well. Hi, Karen.
Hi, everyone.
All right, we have a lot of callers on the phone today, Karen, which is great, and we want to go over the questions of the week that we receive from parents who are maybe getting a little anxious about the upcoming test here in the next 2 months that's going to be taking place, not only here in New York City, but also across the nation. So this is testing season pretty much throughout the U.S. right now. Karen, the first question we have is directed towards you. Let's see. The first question is, what's the difference between the ERB and the WBSI test? Are they the same test? I hear parents talking about the test, and sometimes it sounds like they are the same things, same thing, but other times it doesn't. Can you provide any insight?
Yes, that's actually an easy one. In the New York area, for some reason, the ERB actually administers the test. It's the Educational Record Bureau, and it's through them that children are tested for private school. And the test kids are given is called the WBSI 3. It's the Wechsler test. You'll sometimes hear it referred to as the Wechsler test, but most often the WBSI, WPPSI 3. And so when someone says, my child is taking the ERB, if it's for kindergarten, they're going to be taking the WBSI. If they're a little bit older, they might be taking a different test called the WISC. But there is no test called the ERB. The ERB is just the administrators of this test. So what you want, if you're looking for information, if your child is going to take the ERB, you want to practice with questions that might be modeled after the WBSI 3.
Okay, great. Karen, I think we're getting just a little bit of static maybe from your phone or...
Oh, are you?
Yeah.
I can try calling in on another line. You want me to do that?
Yeah, if you don't mind, and I'll go ahead and answer the next
question. Yeah, you go ahead with the next one. I'll call back in, okay?
Okay, great. Thanks. Let's see here. And the next question we have here, and if anyone has questions while we're talking here, please feel free to chime in. The next question here has to do with... the proctor for the OLSAT test, and it says, does the proctor skip questions if she knows my child is familiar with the material and knows the material for each section? The answer to that question is no. The proctor will not skip any sections or any questions on the test, even if he or she feels that your child has mastered the material. They have to go through every question in the order that is given in the OLSAT test in particular. The next question here is related to the OLSAT test as well. And the question from a parent comes in saying, I was wondering if you could let me know if there are any handwriting requirements for the test. I plan on having my son take the OLSAT and the Bracken and also the Stanford-Binet. And Karen can chime in on the Stanford-Binet piece, and I'll chime in on the OLSAT piece. It really depends on the age of your child. If your child is in pre-K at 4 years old, your child there are absolutely no handwriting requirements for the OLSAT test or the Bracken test. All your child needs to be able to do is to point to the correct answer. At that point, your child or the test proctor will fill in the answer to the question for the test. And if you have a child who's older, kindergarten above, then your child will be required to fill in the little bubble with a pencil. And as the child gets older for pre-K, for ages four, if your child's in pre-K taking the test to go into kindergarten, your child will, it'll be a one-on-one situation. And then as they get older, it really depends on the school. Some schools will still administer the OLSAT one-on-one in the later grades, like kindergarten, first grade. Other schools will have small groups of 3 to 5 students taking the OLSAT at the same time if it's in the school scenario. Karen, is that you who joined? Or?
Yeah, I'm back.
Okay, great. We were just addressing the question on the handwriting requirements for the test, and I went over the requirements for the OLSAT and Bracken. Do you want to chime in on the Stanford-Binet test?
Yeah, I would just say that both on the Stanford-Binet and on the ERB or the WBSI, there is a component where a child will pick up a pencil and do something, do some task. But it's not a handwriting requirement in terms of writing letters or words. It's more like drawing circles or figures. copying figures and shapes type of thing that they need to do for coding or for some other tasks. So, and what happens is on both of these tests, there's usually a comment by the tester as to how the child holds the pencil and maneuvers the pencil. Like, are they using a mature pencil grip? So it, that while they don't need to be able to write letters and their name or a sentence or anything like that, they just need to be able to hold the pencil, ideally with a mature pencil grip if they're developmentally able to do that, and copy some shapes.
Okay, great. The next question here, we'll address it from the OLSAT, and we'll also be talking about the Stanford Binet and the WPSI angle on this question. This question is, I had a question about the results from the test. When do we receive the scores, and when do we apply to schools if our child meets the cutoff? For New York City Gifted and Talented Program, for the OLSAT Bracken test, you will receive the scores depending on how the DOE, how fast they are or not. Usually it's at the end of April, but it's been my experience, the scores are usually delayed by a week or two. So even if they say the end of April, I would probably count on a week delay, probably the first week of May. At that point, you will get a letter from the DOE indicating your child's score and if they qualified for the Gifted and Talented Program and all the process that you have to go through as far as coordinating the school visits, et cetera, that you want to visit the schools either in your district or if you qualify for the citywide program, you can visit the schools as well and do a school tour. One thing to remember is also on these school tours, a lot of these schools actually have tours throughout the year, so I highly recommend if you're interested in seeing particular schools, try to do it maybe not when everyone else is doing it because there's so many parents there, you might not get a good feel for the school. So if you have a pretty flexible schedule, I always recommend to parents to start doing the school tours now. Most school tours, my daughter, she's in a gifted and talented program over here in District 2, and they do have school tours year-round, and they're every month. So you can actually contact the school to see if there are school tours on a monthly basis or every month basis. Some schools actually have them two or three times a month, depending on the school. And that'll give you probably a better feel for the school in general, and it will give you better insights. And then maybe that way you can actually narrow down your list to your top two or three choices prior to when you actually get the results, and it'll save you time, and that way you're not panicked. Because the touring of the schools is actually a very small window of time. So if you live in a district, say like District 2 or District 3 in Manhattan, as an example, you have a very small window of time of like 2 weeks to tour maybe like 8 schools, which, you know, and all this is during the day. So if you work, you have to coordinate schedules, find, you know, or if it's later in the day, find childcare, et cetera. So it can really be a stressful time. So I highly recommend to parents if they have schools they want to look at, to contact the school to see if that school has tours available at a different time prior to when the actual GNT tours take place. And the test results for the Stanford Binet and WPSI, do you want to go over that, Karen? Excuse me.
Well, those come usually a few weeks after your child takes the test. And I would just say that most people whose child are taking either of those tests have probably already signed up for the tour of the schools, you know, that they're looking at. It would be Hunter if you're in New York for the Stanford Binet, and even outside of New York, I suspect you aren't going to get your child tested with a Stanford Binet or a WPSI unless you've already applied to some schools, because this is through a psychologist and it's a little bit more elaborate. But it takes a few weeks, and then you get actually a much better and more thorough report, you know, from especially on the ERB, you get a pretty good report that you know gives you a lot of information about how your child did. Stanford Binet report isn't quite as thorough, but it just takes a few weeks out of the test.
Okay, great. Thank you, Karen. The next question here, we have a couple of questions about Hunter. And for those who aren't familiar with Hunter, Hunter Elementary School is a gifted and talented program here in the New York City for Manhattan residents only. And the only time you can get into Hunter, the Hunter program, is going into kindergarten. Now, Hunter is technically not a part of the New York City public school system, but it is a free program, but the child is required to take the Stanford-Binet test to get into the Hunter Elementary School. It's a very highly competitive school. Only 50 kids are allotted spots going into kindergarten each year, 25 girls and 25 boys. And so a lot of parents, especially here in New York, well, a lot of parents here in Manhattan, you know, I believe there are over 3,000 children applied this year to get into Hunter for a total of 50 spots. So that gives you any indication of how competitive it is to get into Hunter. It's a phenomenal program. I believe over 60%, Hunter actually goes through 12th grade, and over 60% of the Hunter High School graduates attend Ivy League colleges at graduation, which is a phenomenal statistic. It's one of the best schools academically in the nation. So we have a few questions here regarding the Hunter experience. So this looks like a father who's asking this question. He said, there are 290 children in round two. So what Hunter does is they do the first round of testing on the Stanford-Binet, and then a second round where the children actually go into group settings and teachers evaluate them in a group setting for a round two. So out of the 3,000 plus who applied, 290 children age four make it to round two. So there's 290 kids in round two vying for 50 spots. So roughly a 1 in 6 chance. All things being equal, do you guys happen to know if Hunter selects the top 290 scores from round one? In other words, are they chosen on the SV4 criteria alone, or is gender a factor, or did they take the top 145 girls and 145 boys, or just the top 290 scores? Now, we did a lot of research on this, and it's our understanding, but we're going to continue to research this. From our sources, they did indicate it as the top scores, and then at that point, they narrowed down the gender differences in the round two selection. So there will be 25 girls and 25 boys at who are entered into kindergarten for the next year. And then also the question goes on here, this father indicates there's a parental observation form, so and a teacher observation form. So these are forms that you as a parent and you as a pre-K teacher would actually fill out on behalf of your son or daughter if they make it to round two of Hunter. And it says they must be filled out honestly and accurately, but are there specific attributes that should be emphasized for Hunter? Are there characteristics that they turn a keen eye to, both in terms of strengths and weaknesses? Now, as far as that goes, I mean, honesty is obviously the best policy, and I would strongly encourage you to be completely honest, because what's going to happen is your child is going to, if they make it to the second round of Hunter, the evaluators there will have the actual form that you and the preschool teacher completed, and they will make sure that whatever is said on that form is accurately reflected in your child. So it's like there's, you know, I wouldn't say, you know, the best policy here is to be honest. You have to take into consideration Hunter is a teaching school, so they're not looking for all the children to have the same abilities per se. They're not looking for, you know, 50 math whizzes as an example. They want children who are strong in math, children who are strong in creative skills, children who are strong analytically or writing, you know. So they're looking for a well-rounded classroom, not necessarily one type of child that's going to be in a classroom with all other children who are going to have the same sort of strengths that child has. So I'd probably say the best thing on the observation form is to really emphasize the key points that you think your child would be demonstrating in a scenario when they're in when they're actually in an evaluation setting. So the observer can actually see, oh yeah, this child is strong in analytical abilities, as an example. Karen, did you have anything to add to that?
No, I thought that was actually a good description of what they're doing, and they are really trying to put a class together, and just remember that. So you can talk about whatever specific attributes are true for your child, attributes that make your child special, that make your child, you know, a little bit different from other kids. You know, what are they really strong with? And just be honest, because they are looking for an overall class that will, you know, sort of fit in well together. And you just have no idea who else they're looking at, and you can't. And no, you know, so just be true about your own child, and hope that your child fits into the overall picture, the classroom they're trying to create.
Right, and just don't try to portray your child as something they're not. So if your child mm-hmm. is not, you know, highly analytical, you know, don't say, you know, my child can do, you know, double-digit math. You know, it's just, honesty is the best policy here, because they're going to take those forms and really make sure that what you're saying and what the teacher, the preschool teacher, is saying is accurate in a classroom setting. You have to remember, they're going to be with your child for a few hours in round two as well. So it's not like they're just going to observe for 5 minutes. It's like they're really going to get to know the child, you know, to as much as you can over a few hour period. But the child, they'll be able to demonstrate and should see what the strengths of the child are during these sessions. And that's why they have them. And that's why they don't solely base entrance going into Hunter on the Stanford-Binet only. They actually take more of a holistic approach to the entrance to the program, which, you know, a lot of people could debate that for New York City public schools. Unfortunately, New York City public schools, they don't have the resources available to do the test, but then also do the individual evaluation in a group setting. The next question here is, if a child, this is geared toward, this is actually from a new testymom.com member who joined us today, so thank you. And it's, if a child scores a 99% on the GNT test, and this is related to New York City, do the parents have to put Nest is a school here in New York City that is gifted and talented. And once you get into Nest in kindergarten, it's actually a K-12 program, so you never have to retest for the gifted and talented once you're entered into Nest. And do parents have to put Nest, which is a school, down as the first choice somehow? In other words, how do you let the Department of Ed know that you want Nest as your first choice? Let me answer that portion of the question. So first of all, your child needs to score 99 on the OLSAT-Bracken test for the New York City Gifted and Talented Program to get into NEST, which is a citywide program. Now, according to the DOE site, it indicates the child will be eligible for a 97, will be eligible for NEST or a citywide program if they score 97 or above. Well, historically, over the last 3 years, no one who has scored below a 99 has ever gotten into NEST. So you need to make sure that your child is adequately prepared for the test. And, you know, they must score a 99% to be eligible for NEST. And that doesn't even guarantee that they'll get into NEST, just because it's a lottery system as well. So if they have, you know, I believe they have 4 kindergarten classes, so there's approximately 100 students trying to vie for these spots, and there may be like 400 applicants who make 99 who are trying to get into those spots. And once you get the score from the DOE and you score 99, you'll have specific directions on how you need to rank order your schools. So if NEST is your first choice, what you would do is you would put NEST down as your first choice. And then they go through, you know, they do it by a lottery system at that point, and you'll get notified whether your child gets admitted to NEST or not, or as a second choice, et cetera. Let's see. The second part of this question is, also, if the child scores 99%, is entered into the lottery but is not selected, is there ever a way to appeal to the school directly, calling the principal, et cetera? You can try. I haven't heard much success in that. A lot of this is just, especially a school like NEST, it's just because so many parents want their children in there. They're very, you know, you would have to have a strong case on why you're trying to appeal it, because they try to make this as fair as possible. So as an example, if there's 400 students trying to get in these kindergarten spots, that's why they do the lottery system, et cetera. And I believe what they do also is they do have some sort of attrition as well, but usually you'll be notified if you're on an attrition list. So like the first day of school, not all students will show up. So you can call maybe the first day of school to see what the attrition level is. And also, if you're really honed in on NEST and you must, you know, if NEST is your only choice, I would, you know, recommend trying to form some sort of relationship with the principal if you're able to do that prior to actually, you know, selecting that as a school, making sure you're comfortable with the school. But what I also tell parents is, don't get necessarily hung up on like, my child can only do NEST. I mean, NEST is a great school. It's an awesome school. It's an incredible school. I know several parents who take their children there. But the GNT program here in New York City is very strong across so many different schools. So a lot of the GNT programs are integrated into the regular school program, and they're phenomenal programs. So I really recommend parents to, yes, you can put NEST down as your first choice, but don't eliminate other choices and options that are available to you in New York City. There are some incredible programs here. So it's like, leave all options open, be open to the possibility that there may be a great program for your child. And I really tell parents to look at the program specifically, and it is a good program that's going to fit your child's needs and also your needs. You have to take into consideration, in a NEST situation, your child's going to be there for, well, I guess 13 years. So is this a school that you would envision you and your child being involved with for the next 13 years? Is this a school? Is this a fit for your child? So these are the questions that you really need to ask yourself, not just because every parent in New York City wants to get into this school. It's like, what is best for my child and best for their educational needs? Because a lot of these GNT programs may focus on different types of curriculums, et cetera. Karen, did you have anything to add to that?
No, I thought that was quite good and thorough. So I think we're good on that.
Great. The next question here is actually from new testymom.com member as well, the same one. She would like to hear about the take on the Blue School. The Blue School is a school here, for those who aren't in New York City, is a school here in New York City. It's very creative. It's actually founded by the Blue Man Group, if you know the one of the members of the Blue Man Group. Actually, I have a friend who has a son who goes there, who's in kindergarten this year. They actually love it. It really depends on your philosophy and your educational background as far as like what you're comfortable with. It's a very progressive school, so it's not traditional academics. They're very creative and, you know, creative thinking. That's really what they promote in the school from what I'm told. I don't have any personal experience with it, but this is what I've been told from my friend. They personally love the program. It really depends on what you're comfortable with as a parent. If you come from more of a traditional background and that's what you really want your child to do as far as like traditional like math, reading, et cetera, the Blue School may not be an option, you know, the best option for you. Or if you're very comfortable with progressive education, you know, really creative atmosphere, et cetera, maybe kind of more of the Montessori type of atmosphere, the Blue School may be a great option for you. And then they're also talking about here, Karen, and maybe you can chime in on this. They're looking at Packer Collegiate, which is a private school here in Brooklyn, New York. And let's see, I guess the question is, do you have any take? Do you know anything about Packer, Karen? I don't know much about it.
Yeah, I do know Packer. Oh, okay. And I think I have the question here, and she's the mom says that her husband is pushing for Packer, but she says it would be a stretch for them to afford, so she's pushing for a good public school. And what I just wanted to say was, first of all, Packer is a wonderful school. I've seen it. I really like it. But what I was actually more struck by was the second part of the question, which had to do with it would be a stretch, and she's pushing for a good public school. And what I want to say to all parents is that if going to private school is going to be a big financial stretch for you and you're not sure you're going to be able to afford it all the way through, I would think twice about going for private school. And I say this as a parent who sent her kids to private school in New York and to public school in New York. And certainly if I had it to do over again, I would have started in the public schools. And I would have tried to make the public schools work for as long as I could, because the private schools are so expensive and they get more expensive every year. They're wonderful. I mean, there are wonderful private schools in the city, and I can talk about a lot of them because I've seen most of them and they're great. But if it's going to be a big financial stretch and it's going to put a lot of pressure on your family, I think that if you look hard and work at it, you can find a very good public school. You can do that. And you'll save a lot of money. And I know that my husband and I both, looking back, wish we had done that. So, you know, we're now facing college. Our kids are ready to, one is in college and the other is about to start college. And we have paid private school tuition for 13 years for two kids. We haven't been able to put money away for college. So it's almost like we're constantly having to pay for school on a current basis. And it's tough, and it's gotten so expensive. And so I would just say, you know, if you can do private school and, you know, you find one that you love, then that's great, and I recommend it. But if it's a stretch, work hard and try to find a great public school that you can start with. And if it turns out not to be right, you can always switch over to private school. But I think once you start in private school, it's a lot tougher to switch back over to public school, because there's a lot of amenities with the private schools that you get used to, and then it becomes like, oh gosh, you know, this is going to be hard. So, but I know there are great public schools in New York and all over the country. And so I just want to say, you know, if it's a stretch, really try to make a good public school work first, and then you can consider private school. That's just my opinion, so I just wanted to throw that out. Are you there, Michael? Did you? Hello?
Hello?
Michael, I lost you.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm calling in on Skype, so I apologize. I missed like maybe the last five seconds of my rant. No, it was actually really good. No, and for those who aren't in New York City, it's you know, private schools are expensive everywhere, but in New York City especially.
They are. They are. I mean, we're paying for them in Florida now, and they're very expensive here in Florida. So I'm just saying, you know, it's like, you know, now you get to college and it's like, oh God, I haven't been able to save. So I think that's a really big, you know, thing to think about for families is, you know, is how easy is this going to be? And if it's not going to be easy for you, and if it's always going to be a stretch, I don't know that you want to go there. As good as private schools are, and you've had such a wonderful experience with the gifted program that Rowan's going to. So, you know, I know there are good schools everywhere, and you just have to work hard as a parent to find them and get your child in.
Yeah, definitely. And that's what I was going to say. It's like, you know, there are great schools no matter where you live. And if you're here in New York City, you know, a lot of times we hear just the negative things about the New York City school system, which has a million students in it. So it's like, you know, there are a lot of gyms out there in New York City and all over the country. You just have to look and find out what the best fit for your child is. And, you know, especially when you get into a private school situation, it's like, it's easy to go into the situation saying, oh, well, if this doesn't work out, you know, after a couple of years, we'll pull our daughter, pull our son out. But you know what? As your child gets older and they get more involved with the school, you're going to be much less likely to pull your child out of the school just because of the emotional attachment that the child will have with the school. So that's something to take into consideration as well. It's like, it's more than just monetary at that point. It's like, oh, you know, if your daughter's in third grade, you know, 3 or 4 years from now, it's like, oh, we can pull her out then. Well, you know, that's easy to say now, but then when you're in the midst of that situation and your daughter's old enough and she wants to be around her friends, et cetera, it becomes a very emotional decision as well. So it's just
I can throw in just a quickie on that, and that is that, you know, my husband and I, you know, we did send our kids both to public and private, but my son was in private school all along. And at a certain point, we did have some financial setbacks, and we had to take our son out of private school and move him to another school. And, that was the biggest heartbreak for me. I mean, I just felt horrible that we had to do it, but we did. And it was just an incredibly difficult transition for him as well. But so you're right. I mean, it's like it is hard to pull them out, although when the younger they are, the easier it is. As they get like really older, it gets to be a lot harder. But you could certainly start great public school, you know, find the best one you can when they're little, and hopefully it'll work out. And if not, you can move them when they're younger and they're a little more malleable at that point.
Right. And that was one of the things, I mean, for us, it wasn't necessarily a private school situation, but for us, we live in the area we live in, we live next to a very good public school, general ed public school, and that was the one we were zoned for our daughter, which was almost literally across the street from our apartment here in New York City. So, and she went to pre-K there. So for us, after she finished pre-K, that was one of the dilemmas that we had, was like, oh, you know, she's already started school here. Should we pull her out? We're happy with the program that we had in pre-K. Should we pull her out? And we're going to have to, like, you know, schlep her uptown to go to this different school and blah, 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 blah. And for us, even at the pre-K level, it was this big dilemma. So, and she really, you know, at four, they were kind of, you know, they just want to be more around mom or dad versus their friends at that point. So, you know, for us, it was still kind of like, it's, you know, there was the inconvenience factor a little bit, but it's also like, you know, we were already acclimated into the school. And so what we determined was we were going to try it for a year. We were going to try the GNT program for a year, see what happens. And worst case scenario, we can always go back to our general ed school, which was right across the street from where we live. So for us, it was more like, we're going to try it for a year, see what happens, and then we can make a decision after a year. You know, for us, it was the best decision ever that we decided to put her in this program, you know, and we're just really pleased with it. So, and we just have seen amazing progress.
Great.
Okay, the next question here. Oh, yeah.
No, I just wanted to say if I know that there's people on the phone and I don't know how they would unmute themselves, but if people want to ask questions, you want to let them know how to unmute themselves?
Well, I believe, Karen, everyone's unmuted. So if you have a question.
So if you want to ask questions, you have to jump in really fast.
Yeah. If you have questions, we have. I know. I thought people would.
We have more questions, but I just wanted to say that if people had a question, they want to jump in.
We have a lot of people on the phone, so.
I actually did have a quick question. Can I jump in?
Sure. Yeah, jump in. Jump in.
Thanks. Can you just describe briefly what happens? When you show up at the testing center. So who meets you? Where do you go? Typically, just the scenario a little bit, please.
Which test are you taking?
Oh, sorry. I'm talking about the gifted and talented test in New York.
Are you taking it on a weekend, or is your child already in public pre-K?
No, on a weekend. On a weekend, yes.
And you've already got your notice of what time you should show up?
Yes. So we have the notice, and we are asked to show up 15 minutes before that, I guess. I have no idea what happens.
Sure, yeah. Actually, I think I have that as a question. I have a couple of questions that are pertaining to this, so I will actually answer those questions while I answer your question at the high level. So what happens is you show up 15 minutes. It's just more like a check-in. So you'll check yourself in at the front desk, if you will. It really depends on the school. Usually you'll go into the cafeteria, or there'll be an auditorium, and there'll be a waiting area for you, and you and your child will be sitting there. There'll be other parents waiting with their children as well. Parents will be on high anxiety levels, so just be prepared. I would just try to stay as calm as possible for your child. If you see other parents stressing out, pacing, just try to keep yourself away from that, because the anxiety will be, kind of feeds upon itself. So you want to try to keep this as calm as possible for you and your child. So you'll go there, and then what will happen is the test proctor will come out, say your name, your child's name, and then your child will be taken to the test proctor to take the exam. At that point, you will have to wait to see. Mm-hmm. And usually your child's in pre-K right now?
Yes.
Yeah, pre-K. So usually the test will take anywhere from 45 minutes and can take up to an hour and a half. Mm-hmm. So at that point, you're just kind of wait and see. And then after it's over, the child will come out and you just basically leave at that point. It's just more like, it's like them going to the doctor's office, except you don't get to go into the testing place with them. We get that question a lot. So, you do not get to sit with them or be in the same room while they take the test. Mm-hmm. And one of the questions that we had regarding that is, does the test proctor skip questions if she knows my child knows the material? And the answer to that is no. Or did we answer that earlier? Wait.
Yes, you did.
No,
actually.
You didn't.
Yeah.
Okay.
I must have missed that. That must have been when I was changing phones.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Sorry about that. And so, and also a question here is, and I don't know if this was from you, but a woman asked, or a mother asked, her son is taking the LSAT on Sunday. Will the tester give any feedback on how it went in a general way, at least? Absolutely not. So you can, the tester, well, wouldn't, so if your child goes into the testing situation, is in there for, 45 minutes to an hour, and then comes back out, then, you can attempt to ask the test proctor how they did, but they won't be able to tell you. So they just, it never hurts to ask, but I have never heard of a case where the test proctor was like freely giving information out to the parents. Because this has become such a competitive test, especially here in New York City, the test proctors are given very strict rules of what they can and cannot say to the parent, so you can ask your child how they did on the test. They probably have no indication whether they did well or whether they did poorly. They're just going to think, oh, okay, this was just playtime or whatever. One of the things that we actually tell parents to do is like to really calm the nerves of your son or your daughter prior to taking the test. So if you know the facility where your son or daughter is taking the test on a weekend, we highly recommend you go to that facility if you're already not familiar with it, and have your son or daughter play on the playground or go there prior to the test. So go there maybe two or three times prior to the test, just to get them acclimated with the facility. You don't necessarily have to go to the school, but you can say, oh, this is where you're going to come next week. And, there's a teacher here who's going to ask you everything that a four-year-old wants to know. So, and really get your child comfortable and familiar with the setting and surrounding. You don't want your child to walk into the situation unfamiliar with their environment. You want some familiarity with this environment that they're about to walk into. You have to put yourself in the shoes of a four-year-old walking into a strange place with their parent, and a stranger comes out to get them and takes them away. Okay, so that's anxiety for a lot of four-year-olds. So it's like you have to make sure your child is completely safe and okay with that concept. And, you know,
Michael,
just say,
if a child is reluctant to separate, will they let a parent walk with you, walk with the child to where they're going to have the test and then say goodbye? Have you heard of that happening?
There are cases where that happens, but, you know, if your child is having high anxiety walking into this test, your child will not do well. Chances are your child will do poorly on it. So you just want to create a very low anxiety environment, a calm environment as much as you can. And there will be stressed out parents there waiting. So just be prepared for that. Try to stay away from them as much as possible because your child will pick up on their anxiety as well. So what you really want to create...
You should probably bring a book or something to read while you're waiting, something to do.
Yeah, I'm really just... And you really want to make it a positive experience. Yeah.
Another quick question is, do they jump into the questions right away, or is there a period of warm-up with the question, you know, when after the child?
There's a couple of warm-up questions that they do have, and then one of the things that you have to take into consideration, the OLSAT for a four-year-old is broken up into two parts. There's the bracket, and then there's the OLSAT piece. So the total is 128 questions. So the bracket piece will be 88 of those questions. The bracket are more simple concepts. It's more general knowledge, shapes, colors, bigger than, less than. But there are some tricky things on the bracket, like a trapezoid, three-dimensional objects. Your child will be presented with a cube. They need to say cube, not box, or square. So there are some concepts on the bracket that are a little more advanced because the bracket test is given for going into K through second. It's the same test. It's just a sliding scale, so your child can miss more on the bracket and still score 99. So then the OLSAT piece is 40 questions that your child will be presented with, and there's no order in the OLSAT as far as like sections. They're all just the OLSAT, you know, divided into different sections in the practice books and stuff like that. There may be different sections, but the test questions in and of themselves are you know, jumbled, scrambled up. So the child's not going to have verbal reasoning one section and then another section. So they will be scrambled up. And also there are, I believe, last I heard, there are 8 different versions of the OLSAT given. So New York City has an agreement with Pearson. So every child will not be given the same OLSAT test. There are 8 different versions the last time I heard that from one of my sources.
I think a good proctor will probably warm the child up a little bit, you know, say something, talk to him a little bit, but then they'll probably get into the test quickly. But I think you just never know if you're going to get a good proctor or a proctor who's just, you know, all business. But I think most people working with small children are pretty good at warming a child up. Let's hope.
Right, and I have actually met a couple of proctors, and both of them were very warm, and, you know, most of them are former school teachers, pre-K or kindergarten teachers, or they're actually teachers in another school district who do this, you know, on the weekends, et cetera. So like Karen said, these aren't, you know, people who aren't familiar with children and how children respond. So the proctors, you know, in most cases will be comfortable working with the child, and they're trained to make a child feel comfortable because, you know, they want the child to succeed as well, because New York City really wants the brightest and the best kids in this program. So, you know, they're incentivized to make sure that your child is doing the best that they possibly can on this test.
You have a quick question?
Yes.
Is that, I heard actually, you know, there's subsections as part of the test, right? You know, is that true? I was on internet, I was reading actually, you know, if you do like 3 questions wrong in a row, you know, they actually can skip the whole section. Is that true?
No.
Okay.
That, I think that's what happens on a on an ERB test or on a Sanford-Binet. It's what happens is that they if a child misses, they're pushing the child as far as they can go in a particular section. So if they miss a certain number of questions, and on each of the different tests, it's a little bit different. But let's say that if they miss 4 questions or 3 questions, then they go on to the next section. So that's called the ceiling, and they've, in other words, because the questions on those tests get harder as they go along. So they're designed a little bit differently. They're designed from the easier questions to the hardest questions. So they start with an easy question, and they push a child to be able to answer the harder questions later. If they miss a few, then they're going to have to – then they cut them off, and they don't ask anymore. So that's what you were probably reading about. I'm guessing that's what you were reading
okay,
about.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. I was thinking more about, like, all the GNT at New York, actually. So it's not true for OLSAT and Bracken, I guess.
Yeah, the OLSAT has all the questions all mixed up, so they'll go through the whole test.
Okay, very good. And one more thing, Karen, quickly. I heard when I attended one of the sessions, I heard they're probably planning on putting a new GNT school for Queens. Have you heard anything around that, actually?
But Michael, have you? Because you were attending all those sessions.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard about it. I'm not sure when it's opening, though. I don't know much about it. I can do some research for you. So.
We can do some research and maybe bring that up next week, if you like.
Oh, okay.
Is that where you live? Are you in Queens?
Yes, I'm in Queens, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's
all right.
That's one of the drawbacks of the citywide program, because most of them, well, there's a Brooklyn one now, but I think they're opening a Queens one as well. It's like all the citywide programs in the past have been located in Manhattan, so if you live in an outer borough, it's really not convenient for a lot of people.
Correct, yeah.
Okay, let's see here. Karen, here's a question for you. It's mother asks, I have an important question. My son has an IEP. He has language and sensory fine motor skills. Should I be mentioning this to the tester?
Okay. Let me say this. For those of you who don't even know what an IEP is, that's an individualized education plan. And you get one of those in schools around the country if your child has been diagnosed with a learning disability. And what they do is you work with the school district and you come up with a special education plan for your child that maybe gives them some extra time with a reading expert or extra time with a special ed teacher, that sort of thing. And so this mom wants to know, I'm assuming that this is a mom in New York whose child is going to take the test, the OLSAT Bracken. And what I would say is that I would mention it to the tester that he has language or sensory fine motor skill issues. I would mention it, but I don't believe that it's going to have any impact on whether or not, it's not going to change the score that's required to get into the gifted program. But the proctor might be a little bit more sensitive when working with the child if they know that there's a language or a fine motor issue or a sensory issue. So I would mention it just so that the proctor would hopefully be a little bit more sensitive, but it isn't going to change the score. But what I would say also is if your child is being tested, in any situation, like for the WPC, they're getting the WPC or they're getting the Stanford-Binet, if you have any kind of thing that you want to tell the tester, go ahead and tell them, because in some cases it makes a difference. Like if you have a child from a multi-language family and you tell that to the tester who's giving your child the WPC or the ERB, they're going to actually put that in the report. And if your child doesn't do quite as well on the language skills aspect of the test, then the schools will take into account that, oh, well, this is a child from a multi-language household. And kids who live in households where many languages are spoken often don't do as well on the language portion of the WPC. So if you have something you think that you should tell the tester, tell the tester. It may not help, but it also might help, and it certainly isn't going to hurt you. Okay?
Okay, great. And I think that was all the questions we had for today.
Oh, well, wait. I have one question here that
you
may have skipped. Yeah, I do, because I wanted to answer it. Let's see. It says, okay, here is a question we have. We have a problem that I'm hoping you can help us work through. As we do practice tests, we've been very surprised that our four-year-old has been struggling with which ones are different questions. She does fine with them unless the group asks her to sort geometric shapes. We finally realized that whenever the question involves geometric shapes, she thinks it's a which one comes next question rather than a which one is different question. And as a result, she gets these wrong and she gets some of the more difficult questions right because she's mixing up what the instructions are. We're trying to figure out how to help her break out of that mindset, and this mom is looking for some advice on this. I think, you know, that's very, because, you know, these questions after a while tend to kind of start to look alike, and your child wants to jump in and, you know, get right to the question because they think they know what the answer is. And so when you're doing practice questions with your child, one thing that I think is really, really important is to stress, we're going to do these questions, but I want you to listen really carefully to what the question is before you give me the answer. And if you have a child that's jumping in a little too fast, what you might do on some of your practice questions is here you ask them the question, and then you say, but before you give me the answer, I want you to tell me what I asked you, and have them repeat back to you what the question is to make sure that they were listening. And I would maybe do this a few times, or you know, maybe in one of your sessions, where the focus is as much on are you listening to the instructions as are you answering the question right. And so, you know, I think, you know, just making sure that they're listening, talking to them about how important it is to listen, because some of the questions look alike, and unless you listen to what the question is, you're not going to get the answer right. So, you know, and a good way in general when you're trying to help a child learn to listen in many situations is to ask them, what did I just say? Now, will you repeat the question I just asked you? Just to make sure they're listening. So try that. And then the next time you do the questions, you know, you don't want to have them have to repeat it. But just try it once or twice in some of the times that you're working together, and then see if it helps you in future sessions. And one of the things I was going to say, we're going to be sending you these fast five questions between now and really over the next 2 months, where we give you, instead of giving you one question a day, we're going to send you a download for five questions, and we're going to mix them up. So that's a little bit more like what happens on the test. So it won't be like five matrix questions. It'll be just five different questions. And it'll be really important, you know, when you're doing those with your child, that you ask them, now listen carefully. Don't jump in until I finish the question and listen to the question and then answer it. So you can practice with those fast five questions.
Right, and one thing also to consider is when you are practicing with your child, because especially if they're really young, you know, we're talking 3-4 years old, is a lot of 3- and 4-year-olds have never been told, you know, it's the wrong answer. So it's like they need to know the difference. You know, when you're asking these questions, there is a correct answer. It's not, you know, a question that shows balloons and the answer is this one because it has the most balloons. You know, it's like really explaining and listening. It's like, well, let's talk about why the other answers aren't correct as well. And really, as you're practicing with your child on these questions, even if they get a question right, I always tell parents, ask the child why they answered that way. And if they get a question wrong, ask the child why they answered that way. You need to figure out what their thinking process and pattern is so you can really kind of hone in. Was it a listening issue or they don't understand the concept? Those are two different things. The listening issue can easily be overcome. They don't understand the concept, may take a little more work.
That's great. That's a really good point. I think that's a great point, is always ask, you know, why do you say that? You know, and you can really talk about these, you know, that way. I think that's a great point, Michael. Anybody else have any?
Yeah.
Oh, go ahead. I was just going to
ask. Oh, no, I was just
going to
ask. Yeah, we're pushing an hour here. And
I know. but if anybody's, you know, has something pressing that you really want answered, you can ask us now or you can send it to us and we'll get to it next week as well.
Yeah, it looks like we had somebody just join us. And if you did just join us, we are wrapping up the teleseminar, but we will be sending out a link and you can listen to it at a later time. And it will also be on the website here in the next day or two. And if you just joined testymom.com, we actually have the Fast Five on the site now under Parents Resources. So we'll send those to you via email, but we also post them on the site They'll be under parents' resources, and they're at the very bottom, and there's two out there right now that you can download, the Fast Five, and work with your child over the next couple of days. And those are in addition to your daily emails as well.
Yeah, I just have a quick question.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, basically, I was listening to all the, you know, the questions, especially on the listening part. You know, I do have a question, especially on the following directions. I think that's kind of more towards listening and, you know, really giving the correct answer there. Now, for 4-year-olds, right, you know, for pre-kindergarten, right, so is it like, you know, they can go beyond, like, certain sentences, because they can actually, you know, hardly grasp the whole thing, you know, at one shot. So is it like, you know, the paragraph is like, you know, it's only two or three sentences, or it's kind of, it could be like a long, is it like more of a storytelling kind of thing, you know, and then they ask a question around that? Can you?
I mean, there are some story. I mean, there's slight stories. They're not complex stories. So it'll be like, Susie has two pieces of pizza. Johnny ate one more than Susie. How many pieces of pizza did Johnny eat?
Okay.
I mean, it'll
or
be like maybe three.
Or there are also stories, though. You know, like there might be, like on some of the questions where the child has to, you know, use their thinking skills, they might, like, describe a particular scenario that could be maybe four sentences long, and then the child has to look at the picture that answers the question. So watch, you know, the daily questions that are coming your way, and you'll see those because we have quite a few of them, and in the Fast Five as well. And you'll see those, and it's important to the extent possible. I mean, in the real test, in most cases, they're not going to repeat the question. So, you know, you want to ask your child when you do these. Now you have to listen really carefully because I'm not going to say the question again. So listen carefully. And so listening is as much a part of the test as answering the question correctly. And if you do get into a situation where your child didn't listen and says, well, tell me again, you know, go ahead and tell him again, because you want to see if he has the thinking skills to be able to work through the question. But remember that listening is like half the battle, because they can't show their thinking skills unless they've listened.
Right. And one of the things we all, Karen and I both tell parents, is you really have to build up your child's test stamina. That's what we call it. So if your child is fidgety and doesn't like to sit still, and that's a, you know, usually a case with little boys, and some girls as well, but boys seem to have that tendency more so than girls, not being able to sit still, et cetera. So if your child maybe is a little antsy, can't sit still, is to really start, you know, if you have the test coming up in the next few weeks, try to build up the test stamina where you can work with your child, make sure they're sitting still and staying focused for as long as they can, because that's what you want to happen when they go into this testing situation, and they have to stay really focused. And also what Karen alluded to earlier, the test proctor for the OLSAT in particular, cannot redirect the child, so the child will be asked the question once and only one time only. You know, they can say, point to the correct answer. You know, even if the child requests that they say the question again, the test proctor cannot repeat the question. All they can do is encourage your child and say, well, pick your best choice. You know, pick the one you think is the right answer.
So I think that's it. I don't know. Does anybody, any last minute questions? Otherwise, send them our way, and we'll definitely get to them next week.
Yeah, we appreciate everybody attending today. We had a large group, and thanks for everyone's participation. And if you have any questions again over the next week, let us know. We'll be having another one next week as well, and weekly probably through January at least, and then we'll determine in February if we're going to have it weekly or every other week. All right. Thank you, everyone.
Thanks. We'll see you soon. Bye.